there's so many others.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's going to be horrible. We had a big party going.
The only one I remember is like an Italian film, which is basically a romanticized view of the Iliad from a different perspective. It's like, if you can feel Paris, the seduction of like Helen,
uh-huh.
and you know, all the Greeks are like, they have these very pointy beards. Maybe it's a Italian film, too.
Oh, really?
I remember seeing this in like high school with like ancient Greek or whatever, but I don't remember like, any major emotions like Iliad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't think there is.
Everybody's doing like still major.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Okay, let's see. That's my plan.
Yeah. They did do like a very compressed version of the Iliad at the beginning of the Odyssey on NBC, but it was terrible. It was like a 5-minute segment of like Achilles dragging Hector or something.
I think the main problem with making a movie of Iliad is just how unsympathetic Achilles would seem to like a modern movie audience.
Exactly. They would have to draw on the first.
Yeah.
Oh, so just to finish up while we're talking about the movie, I'm just reviewing this for people that listen. So when I was talking about the lamentation involved in epic poetry, I actually connected the quote that I told you that I was going to use from your thing on the web page about that lamentation is coexistent with the concept of the hero. In terms of the theme of the losing pitch of the hero and the amount of love and glory associated with the hero was directly proportional to the grief that the people felt and remembered. And I thought that was a really good formulation of sort of the connection between the lamentation and the playoff. That's it. That helps all, I hope. But we've been going over a lot of the stuff we talked about last week in section, and we will next time too. So, I mean, in lecture, like today's lecture, and the next session. So, that's it. Had a run in with the security people because they had unlocked the doors.
Well, obviously, the talk is very expensive. I thought it was you don't have mine where you can get a lot of
they must have gone somewhere.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm sure they have somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know about it. I've never seen it anywhere, but I wonder if there's like some kind of out like in the suburbs somewhere, some huge Boston place. With oral poetry last week, there's a few things I realized that I didn't say, so that I just want to make clear. Going back again to the sort of video of Ogno that was made in the 30s of, in the former Yugoslavia. Before Harry and Lord Fieldwork in Yugoslavia, people didn't know that the Iliad and Odyssey were composed orally. I know it seems amazing, but they didn't, and they were always wondered and had lots of explanations for why you would repeat lines and half lines and whole themes over and over again, but they knew that it was traditional. They didn't know that it was oral. So that was really the most significant thing about Perry the Lord, and we realized that was only in the 30s. Think of how many centuries people, you know, have been reading Homer and loving Homer and just not realizing one of the most important things about it. And as I was saying before, it's built up of formulaic building blocks. And the smallest block is an epithet, so like swift-footed Achilles. And the largest block would be a type scene, like a feat, or was another example. Mostly feats are the things that you see, but you know, there's whole scenes that are somewhat formulaic that you can use as a building block.
Something like a death scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear a lot of like piercing about the.
Yes, yes. And the poet has those so hardwired in his head that he can do one of those scenes, he can be singing and performing one of those scenes while he's already looking ahead to what he's going to be singing next. So that's sort of the value of having things like this. But what's amazing, what's sort of hard for people like us who are so into books and things like that to imagine is that every single word is formulaic. And it's not that it's not original, because every song is a new composition. Every song is a re-putting together of different lines and half lines and parts of verses and whole verses. But all of it's traditional, all of it's formulaic, and it's just what the poets inherited from a tradition that lasted for thousands of years. And since we've been dealing so much with micro and macro narratives, I just wanted to point out that it is really amazing that this very sophisticated tradition was able to make these micro narratives that had so many messages for the macro narratives. But they also served another purpose as well, because one of the most important techniques of oral composition is expansion and compression. So depending on what your audience's mood is, or what your plans are for the night, or whatever, you know, what they want to hear about that night, you can expand or compress a narrative as short or as long as you want. So the Meleager story could be theoretically expanded to an epic as long as the Iliad, and theoretically the Iliad could be compressed into a story as short as the Meleager story. And they had this whole continuum of stories about Troy, the return of the heroes, about other heroes not even connected with Troy, which they called the cycle of epic poetry. And later Greeks, when I say later, I mean already by like the 5th century BC, classical time, Professor Nash talked a little bit about this in lecture, but they would attribute all of epic poetry to Homer. They would say that Homer invented epic poetry and that he wrote all of it. And so, and they would even say wrote, probably, even though there wouldn't be writing in the conventional code. And this is actually a very common phenomenon, because people attributed the invention of everything to a single great inventor. So there was one person who invented writing, and there was one person who invented farming, and there was like the city of Athens was not like did not grow over time. There was one person who found it and made the city of Athens. You know what I'm saying? It's just sort of like they had these culture heroes, really what we call it, where they had sort of mythological founders and inventors for things. And so it's not so unusual that they would think of all of epic poetry as being invented and created by one person. But you might be curious or just confused as to what kind of time periods we're talking about here for oral poetry versus tragedy, written poetry, things like that. And this is not anything you need to know for the class, but I just, if you're curious, the Bronze Age in Greece, which is a time when there was kings and pharaohs as well, and use of bronze, obviously, and things like that, is where we can trace back a lot of the themes and the language and even some of the material culture of the poems. So we think that, or I think I should say maybe, that the poems were being performed, or some kind of epic poetry that was being performed already in the Bronze Age in Greece. And some of the themes are so old that they are pre-Bronze Age. They go back to Indo-European, traditions that you can show are older even than the language of Greek. So, so that's old. But for the Bronze Age, about 3000 BC to about 1200 BC. I don't want to be too specific, but then epic poetry continued to be performed, and at some point the Iliad and Odyssey had to come together into fairly fixed entities that we have them now. as we have them now. And they started to be six poems probably around 800 BC. And then, there's major debate about this. So I don't want to be, like I said, too specific. But around 800 BC, which is a completely different time period in Greece. It's called the Iron Age, Archaic Greece, different things. But this is no longer the Bronze Age. There's been definitely some sort of break. There's continuity with the Bronze Age, but that there's been a major break, and there was a Dark Age time when we don't have any literature, we don't have anything, we don't have any kind of writing, we don't have anything. And then there's, we move from Archaic Greece to Classical Times, which is usually, Classical Times is usually defined as starting around 480 BC, which is after the Persian Wars, and going to maybe the death of Alexander. Or you could say to the death of Socrates maybe in 399. But I mean, anyway, those aren't dates. I don't want you to like memorize these dates or anything like that. But I just want you to know that when we're dealing with tragedy, as we're about to, or when we start to read Herodotus, that's a very different time period than Archaic Greece. Oh, also I should say that the Iliad and Odyssey are not representative of any one single time. What's amazing about them is that since they are at the end of a long tradition, they contain elements of things thousands of years old, but also things as recent as 800 BC, So it inherits the whole thing, so you can't pin it down. You can't pin the political or social institutions down to any one time or place. You can't even pin the language down because it has some very old language, some very new language. So that's a pretty interesting thing. But when we get to tragedy, you can pin that down to classical Greece, that to 5th century BC is when Euripides and Sophocles and Aeschylus were writing their tragedies that we'll be reading today. Hope that helps you feel like you have some context for these, but I don't want you to feel like you need to be knowing these dates or using them in some way to shed more light on the poem, because really all we want you to do is to find whatever you need to find in the literature itself. Okay, I want to do some follow-up on Penelope's dream. I fear that some of you thought that the passage was too simple, but there was actually quite a lot there, and some of it we didn't get to, so I want to draw out a little bit more. I think there was a lot of debate about whether Penelope knew or not, whether Odysseus was the beggar, whether she was telling the dream to Odysseus. But what I want to talk about right now for a few minutes, if you can give me your thoughts, is what's at stake if she knows.
She sort of, if she doesn't know it's him, she's trying to bait him into like definitely taking action the next day. Like she's telling him exactly what her husband used to do, what she so that she's clear about her condition. She tells him exactly what she wants him to do, but by talking about what my husband would have done with full expectations that he can't do it, I think she's trying to prompt him into doing it. Mm-hmm. Like saying I don't think this is gonna happen though. I see this moment as just, one that's passed through the horn of the ivory gate.
It's the horn ones are the true ones.
So the ivory gate. Yeah. That something that, it's not really subject to interpretation, you can't really deal with it, because by doing that, she puts the onus on him, in other words, to fill the dream, to prove her wrong.
I think that's definitely a valid interpretation. But
reverse psychology.
Sort of. Yeah.
But do you think she's at all sad about the suitors? Do you think she's at all sad that the suitors are going to go? She said she was fond of her teeth. Exceedingly fond of her teeth.
I sort of mentioned my response was about at a deep level. I mean, she's obviously flattered that these people are paying so much attention to. I mean, at least I don't see how you couldn't be. So many men there, if you're a woman.
Yeah, well, and so it's up to her in lots of ways right now. Just what in this dream I feel like, and this is me, that she's deciding. She's saying, I have to make a decision here, right? What does she have to decide? And what are the consequences of her decision?
I was just in between, obviously, this is going back and being a husband and all these, all this flattery that these other people are giving.
So,
there's another choice to make. One, she can choose whether she's going to remain faithful to her husband, her original husband, or suitors, two, who should suitors choose.
And what if she chooses the suitors? What happens?
If she chooses the suitor, then she's pretty much said, Odysseus is dead.
Right.
Then
what does he not get?
What will
Odysseus not get if she chooses the suitors? Yeah, he won't get Klaus because he won't get Nostos, right? He won't get Nostos if she doesn't choose him. And then he won't get Klaus. And this has been being set up for us throughout the poem. And I think at least one of you noticed how that this, in some ways, this has been set up for us throughout the poem in the form of another story to which this story keeps getting compared.
Agamemnon finds out that Agamemnon is like a long-term affair, and he finds out that they're killing him.
Like at least like three times. One of the main ones being in Odyssey 11. Do you remember what happens in Odyssey 11? Specifically, who tells the story in Odyssey 11?
Isn't that where he's gone down to Hades and he speaks to Agamemnon and
And Agamemnon tells him,
watch out for your wife.
Yeah, watch out for your wife. But I didn't get Nostos, and I didn't get Klaus, and this really
sucks. It doesn't even go as far as to say that, like, forever people will remember Agamemnon as a faithful wife.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because this really shows you the power of song culture here, right? Do you want to look,
Let's see. 125.
Okay. Okay, here he is. And then, she says that, I thought I was going to be welcomed home by my children and my servants, but her abominable crime has brought disgrace on herself and all women who shall come after, even the good ones. he's saying that when this happens in the Iliad too, there's a passage about Helen being a subject of